Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now, the Bills are not the only ones who are unbeaten. So are New England and Kansas City, which everybody saw coming. So is Green Bay and Dallas, which you may have seen coming. But so is Detroit, which nobody saw coming. Meanwhile, the Jets' offense is brutal. It's atrocious. It's infuriating, which everybody saw coming. I just thought that I would be the one calling them that and not their own head coach. But it was crazy eyes Adam Gase killing his team, so I didn't have to. You're right, eyes. Your offense is brutal. It is atrocious. It is infuriating. But you're the alleged mastermind. So instead of telling us something that we already know, do something about it. After all, you are the smartest guy in the league, right? Just ask you. And as good as that is, the Jets head coach and so-called offensive wizard calling his own offense atrocious was not even the best quote of the weekend. Not even close, in fact. Because after Denver lost, again, to drop to 0-3, Broncos wide receiver Emmanuel Sanders dropped the quote of the day. Maybe the quote of the week. Actually, the quote of the month and the year in the NFL.
Times are rough around here. You know, obviously, past 3 years, it's been tough, you know. So, trying to get it right. Right now, it's in 0-3. Living in a world of suck.
Living in a world of suck.
Living in a world of suck.
There you go. Living in a world of suck. Go ahead and print up the t-shirts. Carve that into some marble. Shut it down. Let's go home. I don't think anybody's going to beat living in a world of suck for the quote of the year in the NFL.
Living in a world of suck.
Because that's the absolute perfect description of what it feels like to be 0-3 and struggling. We're sitting here at 0-3, man. We are living in a world of suck.
Living in a world of suck.
Like, hey, man, nice to meet you. Where do you live? In a world of suck?
Living
How about
in a
you?
World of suck.
Unbelievable quote. But maybe the most surprising moment of the weekend came in the Giants-Bucks game. And I am not talking about Daniel Jones doing this.
Jones takes the snap, back to throw, steps up, he's going to run. Jones to the five, touchdown Giants! Daniel Jones on a 7-yard run on a 4th-and-5 from the 7. And the Giants have tied it up with 1:16 to go.
Giants radio, tip of the hat. That's pretty cool. And it did get them a win after an enormous second-half comeback. Awesome, right? But the thing that really shocked his teammates was what he did in the second quarter. According to receiver Russell Shepard, Jones came into the huddle and, quote, he started cussing. And we were like, wow, I didn't know DJ could cuss, end quote. Shepard told Newsday that the Giants were still trying to, quote, figure out Jones, but that him coming into the huddle and dropping F-bombs was a great start. Quote, he's like the world's most mysterious man. He's laid back. He doesn't say too much. I've heard him say some things, but I've never heard him cuss before. It was an expletive, and I loved it. I'm a big cusser, and I was pretty impressed. End of quote. Listen, the guy looked great. The guy did look great. I'm not going to crown Daniel Jones just yet, but that's how you win over the huddle and the locker room, by leading from the front with F-bombs and then going out and making huge plays. Plays that Eli Manning could never make at this juncture of his career. You know, and nothing against Manning. The guy won 2 Super Bowls, right? I'm not going to crown Jones. But Jones can just do things that Manning couldn't do in his prime. But I'm not going to crown him. It's one game. A really good game. But it's only one game. But as far as Jones having even less of a personality than Manning, apparently he got that all twisted. You think he's Eli 2.0? Turns out Jones is fraternity flag football guy 2.0. You know, get W's and drop F's is the Daniel Jones way.
We decide what goes, who goes, and when we win and when we lose, which is never.
So they find a way to come from behind and win that game, even though Tampa Bay could have won it with a kick late. They didn't. But let's be real. Let's be real and let's be honest. Everything that happened in the 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. kickoffs was just a warm-up for Sunday Night Football. All those other games were the appetizers. Rams, Browns, the main course, the defending NFC champions versus America's team in America's city. Now, again, to be real, that was not the best game I've ever seen. LA's 20-13 win was not pretty, but it did have some moments. Moments like Cooper Kupp doing this.
Goff in the gun. Browns rush five. Now drop one more. They throw it to the end zone. It is caught for a touchdown. Cooper Kupp running along the goal line from right to left and just tiptoes in that near left sideline to score six.
That's Westwood one. Cooper Kupp, doing this. And Cooper Kupp doing that.
Rams throwing for the end zone. Kupp's got it, and he walks in for the touchdown. Untouched across the face of the end zone from right to left, and the Rams take a 16-13 lead.
That was just too easy. Way too easy. And maybe you've been sleeping on Cooper Kupp, but if so, that's on you. And you should stop doing it immediately because we're talking back-to-back games with more than 100 receiving yards. The ACL is better, and the Rams' offense is completely different with that guy in it. As for the Browns, their offense was not completely different from what it's been in the first couple of games. In short, Baker Mayfield and his elite receivers had their moments, but there were other moments, in fact, lots of them, where the offense was sort of a mess. Cleveland's defense has made some big plays, especially given everybody that they were missing in the secondary, but the offense never got clicking consistently, and it kept committing penalties, and there were some really weird play calls, really strange play calls. Calls that Freddie Kitchens completely owned after that game, you know, like not running the ball on the final four plays inside the Rams five.
Freddie, when you get down to the five, can you just explain the process of why you didn't run at least once?
I should have run it once. Should have ran it three times.
So why didn't you?
I just didn't.
If you're saying that after a game that you realize you should have called run plays there.
I was being facetious. I should have run it one time. I should have. That's what I'm kicking myself in the ass for right now.
Now that's how you own it. And he owned this play from earlier in the quarter as well.
Fourth down and nine. Let's see what they're going to do. I don't see the punter coming out, and they're going to keep the offense out. Here they come. They're coming up on fourth down and nine. Mayfield calling the play. Play clock down to six, down to five. Are they going to snap it? Down to four. Yes, they are, and they're going to run it. And Chubb takes it over the right side to the 40, and he got hit at the 39-yard line. Yikes. Yeah. And the crowd hates that call.
Browns radio. Man, yikes is right. And the crowd did hate that call. And Freddie's assessment of that play call was probably the same as yours.
What happened on the fourth and nine play call?
Bad call.
Did you want that play call?
Yes, I wanted that play call.
What was your thinking on that?
It just didn't work. It was a bad call.
I'm telling you, I mean, you don't like the result if you're a Browns fan, but that's why he's America's coach. Because those were bad calls. And because he's standing up there and owning it. What happened? Bad call. Did you want that call? Yes, I did want that call. It just didn't work. Bad call. That's on me. So his team went toe-to-toe with the NFC champs. They didn't play as well as they would have liked, and yet they still had a chance to rip it. That's not making me want to abandon them. That's making me appreciate it even more. And so should you. So what I'm saying is, I'm not jumping off that bandwagon. I didn't after they got punched in the face by the Titans in the opener, and I'm not right now. Odell Beckham Jr. said this after the game.
I don't want to give an excuse that we're a young team and we're fresh and new together, but we're still trying to find ourselves and find our identity and find, you know, like I said, this Rams team has been together. They know what plays, when, this, that. It's just what they've done. They didn't get to the Super Bowl by luck, you know. So, like I said, we're going to put it all together. We're just finding the pieces right now. And I feel like once we discover exactly who we are in this team and everyone knows exactly who we are, we'll be able to close games like that.
I like that. I agree with that. That's reasonable. There's no panic. Once again, I'm not going to abandon that crew. Not even close. That wagon was not built in a day, and it's not going to get destroyed in a day either. They do have a lot of new faces. They are finding themselves in their identity. You don't clinch a playoff spot in September. It's about the long haul. Furthermore, this is not about the Browns losing. It's about the Rams winning. It's about LA going on the road in prime time and finding a way to grind out a win in a hostile environment. To quote one Philip Douglas Jackson, give them some freaking credit. I mean, for real.
Give them some credit. I mean, for real.
It's a good win for the Rams. I've got a really important Monday question for you. What do you want when you're craving protein or you need some more energy? Not bars, not sugary snacks. What you want is beef. Pure and simple, beef. So where is the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your father's jerky, not shriveled or dry or tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It's tender, it's tasty, it's not tough. So why is it so good? Because Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for its relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef very seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein, and it comes in four great flavors to satisfy all your cravings. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes wherever you go. To the game, to the gym, to the beach. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? We are joined by Jordan Poyer. Jordan, nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. How are you doing?
Good, Jordan. Good to have you back. What's it like to wake up on a victory Monday knowing that you're 3-0? How is life for you right about now?
No, it's exciting, man. Anytime you get a win on Sunday, it's exciting to come in the building on Mondays and enjoy it. You know, obviously, you know, a huge one this coming weekend, but you definitely want to enjoy the ones, enjoy the tough ones when they come by.
No doubt. So going back to yesterday, Jordan, the team won the first two games on the road. Then you come back home and you play in front of your fans for the first time. How would you describe the atmosphere in Buffalo yesterday?
Yeah, it was electric, man. You know, the fans were excited just as much as we were to come out and play at home, and to see them come out and show out to a sold out game, and to hear them from the first whistle to the last whistle loud. It was very electric, and it was a fun atmosphere to play in.
Jordan Poyer joining us. You know, late in the game when you guys were down 17-14, Josh Allen hit tight end Dawson Knox, and then Knox just started to hit Bengal players. He was trucking one dude after another. It was amazing. Micah Hyde said, quote, "When you're a defense and you see that stuff coming from the offense, I think everybody jumped off the bench, was excited. The crowd went wild," end quote. So what was your reaction to that play, and how much did that fire you up?
Yeah, man, I think exactly what you said. You know, I think our whole team jumped off the bench on the sideline, and I mean, dang, they almost ran on the field. You know, I think we almost could have got a penalty for you know, how excited we were for that play right there. You know, it was a huge play, one in the game, and for it to happen like that, you know, to stiff arm one dude and then chuck another dude and get the first down for us, you know, it was huge for us. It was a huge momentum swing, and, you know, it gave us a little bit more juice to come back and win the game.
The craziest thing is I'm sitting there in my living room in California, and I felt the same way, and I had nothing to do with anything, man. When dude put his head down and finished that run the way he did, I thought that was amazing. And then when you talk about finishing runs, how about Frank Gore? He finishes off that drive to give you the lead, and then the defense finishes it off when Tre'Davious White has that interception. You had told him in the second half that he was going to make that play or a play that changed the game. What did you see that made you feel that way, and how pleased were you with the way he delivered?
You know, Tre'Davious one, he's a great player, and he had already had a pick in the game, and you know, I always feel the interceptions come in waves, and you know, I just felt, you know, that he was going to get another one, he was going to get another opportunity. You know, the offense had to put the ball in the air, and you know, he was going to get an opportunity to make a play on the ball. So I remember I told him, I looked at, hey, you're going to make a play to get to change the game, just keep playing. And you know, fortunately, you know, he had a play. I mean, he had a tip ball came to him, and he sealed the game for us. So I'm real happy for him. I'm real happy for this team, and you know, just want to continue to believe in each other and continue fighting for each other.
Jordan Poyer joining us. You know, Jordan, it's early, but you've been around the league a while. When you look around the talent that you have on that defense, is it the best defense that you've played on?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I mean, I was in Cleveland for 4 years, and we weren't very good out there during that time area. And you know, being out here for this is now my third year out here. You know, we had some really good defenses out here, but, you know, this is our third year in this system. A lot of the guys, third year in this system, and, you know, some guys, second year in the system. And I think, you know, just being in the system with all these guys the same amount of years, you know, just the way we're able to communicate and able to talk to each other, watching film and on the football field, You know, it's a fun group to be a part of, and you know, I think we understand that, you know, we can be a really elite defense. We can be an elite defense, and if we just keep working, continue to put the work in, and we have the right guys to do it.
All right, so obviously, part of that is the talent. Part of that's the consistency within the system that you mentioned. But how much of this unit being as good as it is about the relationships and the brotherhood that you guys have, and how much of those bonds show up on the field?
Yeah, you know, I think those, that's just as important. You know, guys, we're always hanging out. I mean, one, we're in Buffalo, New York. You know, it's an amazing city. But you know, there's not a whole lot to do out here in Buffalo, New York, other than hang out with each other off the football field. You know, we're always, you know, every Thursday the DBs are going to dinner somewhere, and you know, we're always Jerry Hughes is always having people over at his house. You know, watching the Thursday night games or the Monday night games or whatever it is. You know, we're always hanging out with each other off the field, and I definitely think that translates over on the field. It, you know, it brings that environment. You know, coming to work each day. You know, you're not coming to work with your, you know, your coworker. You come to work with your buddy. You know, you come to work with somebody that you respect, somebody that you enjoy being around. And so, you know, it's a culture that Sean, you know, our head coach, has brought here to Buffalo that we just want to continue to build. And, you know, I think that definitely translates over on the field. You know, and in the fourth quarter when times are hard, you know, you're not looking at just your teammate. You're looking at your brother. You want to fight for your brother. So, you know, it's been a fun, you know, 3 years that I've been here. You know, this is definitely the best defense that I've been on. You know, we just want to continue to build that.
Jordan Poyer joining me for a few more moments. You mentioned the fourth quarter. It seems to me like as a defense, you guys talk about calm breeds calm. I like that line quite a bit, and I would imagine especially in the fourth quarter, it's critical. What does that exactly mean, calm meets calm, especially as it relates to the relationship between the offense and the defense?
You know, you look at a sudden change in the game, you know, something bad happens, you know, and the defense, you know, I'm just giving an example. The defense has to go out there and, you know, make a stop. The defense has to go out there and win the game. Like, for example, yesterday, defense has to go out there and win the game. And nobody blinked, you know. Nobody on defensive side blinked. Nobody was, you know, looking scared out there. It was just like, it was another time of us going out there and doing what we have to do. You know, it was nothing more, nothing less. Like, hey, let's go out there and let's end this game. Nothing more, nothing less. And that's exactly what we did. And, you know, it just shows that the mental toughness that our team has, that the guys in the locker room, you know, show out there on Sundays. And like I said, it's a fun group to be a part of.
All right, so before I let you go, you got a whole week to get ready for it, but you've got the Patriots coming up on Sunday in your place. When you're facing Tom Brady and you're facing that offense, what is the biggest key to stopping them?
Man, you know, gonna have to study all week, you know. They do a lot of really good things. Obviously, Tom has full control of that offense. You know, he has some weapons on that side of the ball that he can get the ball to. But I think, obviously, you know, main thing, you got to stop the run. You got to be able to affect, you know, to be able to affect Tom, be able to get him off the spot, and being able to take the ball away. We got to be able to take the ball away and hopefully, you know, not just take the ball away, but score, maybe change the dynamic of the game. And, you know, I think that's going to be the main keys.
Jordan, finally, going back to the Mafia, the Bills Mafia, for one thing. It was out in force yesterday. What kind of noise are you expecting from that crowd on Sunday when an undefeated Patriots team comes in to play an undefeated Bills team?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be electric, man. It's going to be electric. It's going to be one for the books. Definitely a great opportunity for this football team to go out there and show that we can play with the elite, you know, because obviously that's a really good football team in New England, and they're coming to Buffalo, and, you know, we want to show them, you know, who we are. So we're going to prepare all week and get ready for this football game, and it's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. So hope everybody tunes in.
And I would imagine your mindset's got to be, not only do we have to deal with them, but they've got to deal with us, and they've got to deal with us in our own house. Buffalo is 3-0 for the first time since 2011. Jordan Poyer coming off a huge game. Jordan, great to have you back on the show. Thanks for making time on this Victory Monday. Really nice to get caught up with you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jim. I'll talk to you soon.
Normally it's in the past, but when it comes to one particular game, it's still very much in the present. Wisconsin 35, Michigan nothing. Do not let that final score fool you. That was not a 35-14 game. That was a 35-0 game. That was Michigan being down 28-0 at halftime. That was Michigan getting outrushed at one point, 200-0. You want to talk about a world of suck.
Living in a world of suck.
You want to talk about living in a world of suck. And don't get me wrong, there's no shame in losing to Wisconsin. It's a damn good football team. with a damn good football coach and an absolute monster at running back, Jonathan Taylor, rushing for 203 yards and two TDs. That could happen to anybody. And it could have been a hell of a lot worse for Michigan had this guy not left with cramps. Michigan's lucky he didn't go for three Bills, because he probably would have, because this guy can fight for the tough yardage like he does here.
With Jonathan Taylor, Cohn turns, gives to Taylor, into the line, fighting for it again, trying to move the stack, no signal yet, yeah. There it is, touchdown Wisconsin, take two.
Learfield, IMG, college radio. He can kill you with the tough yardage, and he can wreck you with his sprinter speed on runs like this.
Hand off to Taylor, cuts left, has room, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50. Taylor to the 40, he's to the 30, accelerates to the 20, 10, 5, touchdown, Jonathan Taylor, 72 yards, and it's 13 to nothing, Wisconsin.
You see this dude, he's a monster, like he is good, like not just one of the best to ever tote it for Wisconsin, good, which is saying a hell of a lot. Good, like, by the time he's done doing what he's doing, we'll be talking about him as being one of the best to ever do it on that level. That good. Like, historically good. Wisconsin is good. Like, playoff good. That good. The problem is, people thought that Michigan was good, too. And they're not. If you lose a tight game to Wisconsin, that's one thing. Again, Wisconsin is really good. They're the real deal. But if you come off a bye, and you had 2 weeks to prepare for that game, and you find yourself down 28-0 at halftime and 35-0 not long thereafter, man, that's embarrassing. That's unforgivable. That's on your coach. Michigan was out-prepared, out-coached, out-played. And those aren't my words. Those belong to Jim Harbaugh. And Harbaugh's right. And for the first time, like maybe ever, Harbaugh owns something. Then again, what choice did he really have? That was embarrassing. And for it to happen again on that big of a stage in year number 5 is inexcusable. As Brady Quinn said at halftime, quote, "It's honestly sad," end quote. You talk about being in a world of suck. The only thing worse than criticism is pity. And that's where Michigan football is right now. Pity. Condescending pats on the helmet. It's honestly sad, really sad. Like, how the hell is it possible that 5 years in with Harbaugh, Michigan football still has no identity? Well, other than knowing that on the biggest stage, they'll no-show, and he'll take a big dump in his pants. That's not me bumping my gums. It's not me bumping my gums either, just to bump my gums. Look at the numbers, Michigan man. In fact, you already know the numbers, Michigan man. You already know what they are on the big stage since he showed up. The whole point of hiring Harbaugh was to give that program an identity and to stack trophies. You know, the Michigan man who was going to get them back to Michigan football. Yet they've got no identity. Their identity is getting jacked up in their biggest games repeatedly. The so-called quarterback whisperer has turned into a grab bagger on offense. And the defense now is getting humiliated time and time again. And it's not for a lack of talent either. For years now, everybody's heard how Harbaugh is just killing it on the recruiting trail. How he's able to connect with high schoolers because of the zany antics. You know, like the sleepovers, the shirtless football, the pounding of milk. But it hasn't led to results, has it? Here are Michigan's last 5 games. 62-39 loss to Ohio State to end the regular season. 41-15 loss to Florida in the Peach Bowl. 40-21 win over Middle Tennessee. 24-21 double OT win over Army. 35-14 beat down to Wisconsin in a game that wasn't nearly that close. So now the question, is this the end of the Jim Harbaugh era? I got a better question. When did the Harbaugh era even begin? Was there even a Jim Harbaugh era? Seriously, what is the best moment they've had since Jim Harbaugh was hired? The Citrus Bowl win? Going 8-5 in year 3? That time he played shirtless football in khakis? Even tougher, what's been the worst moment since Harbaugh was hired? Was it Saturday? Was it that 23-point loss to Ohio State last year? Was it the 29-point loss to Penn State in 2017? Was it one no-show after another in big games? Like, Michigan fan, I know how hyped you were when this guy came in. Not anymore, right? This is not what you were expecting. When you're getting steamrolled by Wisconsin, those sleepovers with recruits, and the pillow forts with 2% milk, it's not translating into wins. Not so cool, is it? Like, what happened to Jim Harbaugh? What happened to the enthusiasm unknown to mankind? This is not year one. This is not even year three. It's year five. He built the program in his own vision. He recruited his own players. He hired his own staff. And what does he have to show for it? Like, nothing. Instead, he's getting this kind of reaction from respected alums like Charles Woodson in the studio.
I'm sick about how Michigan football looks right now. And I came here on this show, man. This is my first weekend on Big Noon Kickoff. And I came here with high expectations for how my team was going to look in front of you guys. And I'll be honest with you, man. I'm embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed about that.
It's like one of the ultimate Michigan men, Charles freaking Woodson, getting on TV and saying, I'm embarrassed. Hey, Chuck, I feel you. I'm embarrassed for you. You deserve better. So does everybody who ever attended Michigan. So where do they go now? Look at their schedule. There are plenty of losable games on that schedule. And what if Ohio State gets him again? Is that then officially the end? Or does he find a way to beat them and does he buy himself a little more time? Like, I know this. I'll say this. When he got there, it seemed like he could stay as long as he wanted. That obviously is not the case. He's not bigger than the program, especially since he can't win a game that matters. And they're not getting a return on that crazy investment they made in him either. They're paying him Nick Saban money for Brady Hoke results. Except these might be even worse than Brady Hoke results. At least Brady Hoke beat Ohio State. Outplayed, outcoached, outtoughed, and outclassed is a terrible way to go through life, Michigan fan. Except by now you're probably used to it. Coach him up, Jimbo. Coach him up because now your job and your legacy depend on it.
Who's got it better than us?
Everybody! He is Jeffrey Chidiha. Jeff, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing well. How you doing, Jim?
Good, man. Good. Great to have you back. So you were in Kansas City yesterday for the Ravens-Chiefs game. Pat Mahomes goes 27-37, 374 yards, 3 touchdowns, no picks, and it was his lowest yardage of the season. Jeff, how insane is that a performance like that is actually one of his worst statistical games of the year?
Well, it's scary what's happening in Kansas City with him right now, Jim, and I almost feel like he's transcending the sport. It's to compare him to other quarterbacks now, it almost seems futile because you look at what's happening with the NFL with Drew Brees going down, Roethlisberger going down, Aaron Rodgers isn't playing the same level, Tom Brady isn't at the same level. I feel like this is like Wayne Gretzky coming in the NHL now. It's like Sandy Koufax in baseball. It's like Michael Jordan taking off. It's that level of superstardom because what he's doing is insane because this week he came against a really good defense, and he's making it look easy. So to me, it's like he's just starting his career, and he looks like a guy who's already a legend.
Jeffrey Chidiha joining us. I mean, those are really strong statements, and I agree with you. He not only did it against a defense that's a really good defense, but it was a defense that gave him trouble last year. I mean, Jeff, the fact that this is only his 20th regular season game of his career, how do you explain that he's doing what he's doing so early in his career?
Well, it's interesting because he drew a lot of comparisons to Brett Favre when he came out of school because of the way he played, running around, you know, freewheeling, the big arm. From the first day I watched him, he always seemed like Joe Montana, like a more athletic version of Joe Montana because of his mind, his vision, the things that we don't talk enough about, the way he's able to be disciplined. And when you talk about the fact that this is a guy who last year was the best quarterback throwing from the pocket, people tend to underestimate that part of his game because he is such a highlight machine, but he really can cut you up any way you want to be cut up. And I thought the best part about the game yesterday was the way it ended and the fact that 39, you know, they want to run some clock. They call a screenplay that he wanted to run from the game plan meeting the night before, and they executed it. 39, got 16 yards, but he wasn't trying to make a highlight throw. He wanted to do an efficient play, get the first down, get the win. So that shows you how he's growing.
Jeffrey Jadeha joining us. You know, we know he's got all these crazy tools, but it's the intangibles too. For instance, there's no doubt that he's got weapons around him, but he's doing it despite the fact that multiple players on that offense have been banged up. And as one teammate told you, quote, he always looks super confident no matter who's out there. He trusts everybody and we're trusting him, end quote. So what does that say about Mahomes as a leader?
Well, he's next level now. And that, to me, is what also, you know, really stood out was the fact that last year when they lost Kareem Hunt, you saw the offense take a dip. Last year when Sammy Watkins got hurt, you saw the offense be affected. They were still putting up numbers, but it wasn't as prolific as it was before. Now when he's taking those hits to the offense, he's raising the game with the people around him. I mean, DeMarcus Robinson has been a backup who's done relatively nothing in Kansas City for the first 4 years of his career. Looks like a guy who's going to get paid a lot of money in free agency this coming year. Mecole Hardman was a raw athlete who couldn't really run routes when they got him. He's going down the field like he's Cliff Branch every week now. It's the guy can make other players better. And I think just that, you know, again, the arm is real. All the physical talent is legit. But you talk to guys in that locker room, they feel like this guy has a resolve, a understated leadership ability about him that makes everybody feel like when he's in the room, they're going to win.
Jeffrey Jadeha is joining us. What about the relationship, Jeff, that he has with Andy Reid? Like, we know what kind of work Andy Reid's done with lots of different quarterbacks. How much has that relationship between the two of them changed from last year to where it is right now?
I tell you, every time I see Andy Reid walk into a press conference now, it's like Thanksgiving. Like, he's got a big spread in front of him. He's ready to go eat.
Right.
He's feeling good about life because he knows whatever he's calling with this kid, whatever he's running, it's going to work. And you go back to when he first met Patrick Mahomes, when they were interviewing him before the draft, you know, Brett Beach brought him into his office, and Andy spent 6 hours talking to the kid, going over X's and O's. And back then, he wasn't, you know, a high-profile, big-name guy. Just yet. Deshaun Watson was the guy people thought they would take. But when he came out of that meeting, Andy Reid went up to Brett Beach and said, this kid is really smart. And Andy Reid's been around a lot of smart quarterbacks. He will push you. He will press you. And so, again, you know, Patrick is so bright. And I think that people talk about the fact he may have a photographic memory because they have thrown a huge amount of the playbook at him from day one. His recall is great. His ability to process information is great. And when you see him going forward and just learning more and seeing more, it's scary to think about what he can become.
Jeffrey Jadeha joining us. All right, so in terms of developing quarterbacks, what do you make of what you saw from Lamar Jackson yesterday?
You know, I didn't think he did too bad. I thought what surprised me, because I had seen him play against the Cardinals the week before, was that they got into a position where they got down a couple scores, still in the first half. They started dropping him back. And I don't know if they felt so confident in him as a drop-back passer at that point in terms of how he's developed that they could do that. But it definitely changed the way he played. He became a lot more hesitant and didn't look as confident. But when he is playing in the way they set that offense up for him to play, very similar to what Greg Roman, his offensive coordinator, did with Colin Kaepernick in San Francisco, looks like a monster because you saw the moves in the open field yesterday. You didn't see the accuracy he had in the first 2 weeks, but that's there. I think that they got away from some of the three tight end stuff. They weren't able to get Marquise Brown involved in that game, but that's going to be part of their game plan going forward. And I think he has made strides as a passer, and I think he is, you know, he's not at the same level as Patrick Mahomes, but he's getting to a place that's also pretty dangerous.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, when you look back now at all that talk about him being better as a running back or better as a wide receiver, I mean, it's such a joke. It's so wrong. When you look at last season and you look at the way he's playing right now, I mean, maybe not Mahomes good, but how good can he be? What is his ceiling?
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, you talk about all that talk about what he was going to be. Look at what Jalen Hurts is going through at Oklahoma right now and how his game has evolved. I think there are more quarterbacks who are going to look like Lamar Jackson going forward in this league. There are already a lot who look like him right now. You can look at Dak Prescott. You can look at Mitch Trubisky. You can look at Josh Allen, guys who can, you know, Kyler Murray, Russell Wilson. You look at guys who can make plays with their legs and their arms. And what a lot of really smart offensive coaches are doing now is they're going and looking at college concepts and saying, let's use some of this stuff. We have guys who have unique skill sets, who maybe not traditional skill sets, but they can succeed in this way. And I agree with you. I think that a lot of people thought he couldn't be this kind of NFL quarterback that we're used to seeing. Well, maybe we have to change what we think an NFL quarterback needs to be going forward now.
Jeffrey Chidiha joining us. All right, so there have been reports, Jeff, that Kansas City might be interested in acquiring Jalen Ramsey. Based on your reporting, how serious is that interest at this moment?
Well, at the start of this whole thing, it really was lukewarm. I had reached out to a source in the organization who told me the day that news broke that they probably weren't going to make a run at him. They feel like their locker room culture is really strong. And that's not to knock Jalen Ramsey as a person who's never had off-the-field problems, but they know that if they bring him in there, one, it's going to cost them a lot of draft picks. And they want, what, 2 first-round picks. That number supposedly, reportedly, has gone down to 1 and 3. I'm not sure about that. But still, to give up 2 more draft picks after you gave up a first and a second for Frank Clark, you would end up not having a first or a second-round pick in this year's draft. It's a lot to give up. Then you have to talk about paying the guy. And you have Chris Jones in your locker room who's been waiting for a new deal patiently, tried to, you know, make some waves in the offseason by not reporting, but he's been a good soldier. They want to take care of him. I just don't see how fiscally they can pay Jalen Ramsey what he would want, give up those draft picks, and feel good about going forward. So everything I've heard about it so far is that they're not ready to make those kinds of moves. I think personally, a guy like Patrick Peterson in Arizona makes a lot more sense, and I think they're a lot more high about the possibility of getting him at some point.
Jeffrey Chidiha joining us for a few more moments. So, Jeff, 3 games in, are the Chiefs the best team in the AFC, or does that honor still go to the Patriots until somebody beats them?
I have to go with New England. You know, I've had so many moments in the last 20 years where I said, okay, this is the end of the dynasty. It's over. They can't keep doing this. And they've won 3 of the last 5 Super Bowls. That defense is real. I think the fact that Bill Belichick is more involved after Brian Flores went to Miami to coach that dog crap team that I think is scarier now for opponents because he's more involved in it.
Right. Agreed.
I really feel as if they're the best. They're the best overall team. Now the Chiefs have the best offense in football, but Belichick, you give them a great defense and you give them Tom Brady, they're tough to beat. I still like them number one.
All right, then finally, before the season, you did predict that the Saints and the Patriots would meet in the Super Bowl. That was obviously before Drew Brees went down. Almost no team can survive losing a Hall of Fame quarterback for an extended period of time. But when you look at how they handled their business on the road in a notoriously tough place to play in Seattle, is New Orleans possibly built to withstand this?
That was the most shocking game of the week for me because I thought at the very least it would be a close game that the Saints would lose. To go in there and pound them the way they did. Hats off to Teddy Bridgewater because he proved that he is still a guy who can do some things in this league. I think some people were really wondering what he could do. And look, that division is really, it went from being the best division of football to being the most mysterious because the Carolina Panthers are a mess right now. The Buccaneers have never found a way to get things going with Jameis Winston. And the Falcons are up and down. So if they can just tread water here, if they can get through, you know, 6 weeks at 3-3 or even 4-2, I think they're in good shape going down the stretch when Brees comes back.
He is an NFL.com senior columnist and NFL Network on-air talent, a Sports Emmy Award winner, and a good friend of this program, Jeffrey Chidiha. Jeff, it's great to have you back. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you, man. Always a pleasure.
And now we've got the Patriots situation and Antonio Brown. And I want to start the third hour with that. The Patriots beat the Jets. And during that game, with New England up 30-7 in the fourth quarter, the Patriots go with Jarrett Stidham at quarterback. He throws an interception that was returned for a TD by Jamal Adams. In the very next series, Tom Brady was back in the game. So why is that? Because Bill Belichick is a no-nonsense badass. Because Bill Belichick is a tough guy. Because Bill Belichick will never, ever tolerate somebody not doing their job. And he wants to send a message, everybody is accountable, no matter what the score or time in the game is, no matter what the situation is. Do your job. In a related note, New England released Antonio Brown Friday afternoon. So this is going to be a take that mentions Antonio Brown, but not a take which is about Antonio Brown. You know, I'm not going to get into his tweets over the weekend or try to figure out what he's doing or what's wrong with him or give some diagnosis or speculate on what his future might look like. There's no point in any of that because this is no longer about Antonio Brown. Not anymore. We know who he is. We know what he's revealed himself to be. And no, I'm not letting the guy skate. Hell, we've talked about Antonio Brown every single day for weeks, literally months. There's nothing new to say about him. Again, we know who he is and what he is. So this is not about him. Not now. Now it's about the team. Now it's about the Patriots. Late Friday, the Patriots released Patriots wide receiver Antonio Brown. And they did so with one of the strangest statements ever. Quote, this is from the team. Quote, the New England Patriots are releasing Antonio Brown. We appreciate the hard work of many people over the past 11 days, but we feel that it's in the best to move in a different direction at this time, end quote. You appreciate the hard work of many people over the past 11 days? What does that mean? Which people? Antonio Brown? Robert Klemko, who crushed it as a reporter, doing the work that the Patriots themselves should have done before they signed Antonio Brown? But go ahead, put that weird statement aside for a minute. Let's look at how Bill Belichick handled this on Friday. Here's Belichick meeting with the media Friday.
Was there ever a point where some of the off-field stuff is enough?
Okay.
Enough, too much?
Yeah.
I have another different question. I have a non-Antonio Brown question.
Thank you. Well,
yeah, we had enough of that. I said a non-Antonio Brown.
I don't think he likes you.
So that's Belichick meeting with the media after Robert Klemko reported that Antonio Brown had been sending text messages to an accuser that could be qualified as, quote, intimidating. Again, Antonio Brown, the player that Bill Belichick signed and stuck by after there were allegations of sexual assault, and now he's been accused of more inappropriate conduct by a second woman and then accused of attempting to intimidate that second woman. And then when Belichick is faced with those questions, he bolts, just turns and walks out. And then the team releases Brown shortly before 5 p.m. on Friday, a classic news dump, attempting to bury the story and the relationship with a player that they signed. Don't fall for that. Don't forget any of this, because the Patriots want you to. That's why they did what they did when they did it. Bury the story, hope it goes away. And exactly no credit for cutting Antonio Brown, because you know they didn't want to. And they did everything they possibly could to keep Brown and play him yesterday against the Jets. They want you to know that through anonymous sources that if they had known about that sexual assault lawsuit, that they would not have signed him in the first place. But then when they did know, they didn't get rid of him. They kept him. And they made sure that he played against the Dolphins. And they fed him the ball. And then they refused to answer questions about it. Again, this is a guy who will bench a backup quarterback in the fourth quarter of a blowout to send a message, but he will not answer a serious question or questions about an extremely serious topic. And it wasn't just the Friday ripcord quit job that Belichick wouldn't answer questions for either. Here he was again yesterday with Dana Jacobson.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what was the final straw with Antonio Brown?
Yeah, we're focused on the Jets today.
Thank you, Coach.
If you see the video, it's not just the answer, it's the stare down afterwards. You know, again, tough guy leader, staring down a reporter after being asked a totally reasonable question about a Pro Bowl receiver that you stood by for more than a week and then cut less than 48 hours earlier on a Friday afternoon, right? It's not like she just asked him about something from the ancient past. It's not like she asked him about Aaron Hernandez. You know, I mean, what is that? Just being a jerk? Or a coward, or both? And it's not good enough to say that everybody knows that Belichick is going to be a jerk in that situation. Just because people know you're going to be a jerk doesn't make it okay to be a jerk. She's just doing her job, Belichick is the one who was not doing his job. And no, it's not good enough to know or to say that she should have known that he wasn't going to answer it. He should answer it. He's got a lot to answer for. Again, like, when did the Patriots know and what did they know? Because Robert Klemko, who reported on the issue, came on the show last week and said they should have known.
If they didn't know, which I don't think is true, then somebody in their security department needs to get fired, because it took about four phone calls to find a bunch of these people who are alleging misconduct against Antonio Brown. And there are more than just Drew Rosenhaus and Antonio Brown and Darren Heitner, his lawyer, who know about the sexual assault lawsuit. You know, we heard about it from assistants, former assistants of his, videographers, who all were aware of it before it came out.
So how did they not know? Klemko knew. Not only did he know, he says it was not that hard to find it either. So Belichick signs a player who had just threatened to punch a coworker in Oakland, a guy with enough red flags for a parade, and was so cavalier and smug about the whole thing when people dared to ask him about it. And then reporters, when they asked him how he'd fit in, Belichick said the following.
That's the same thing you said about Randy Moss when we brought him in. So,
hey, Bill, is it? Is it really the same thing as Randy Moss? Because I don't remember Randy Moss being sued in federal court for three incidents of sexual assault within hours of joining the Pats. And I don't remember a second allegation that Sports Illustrated reported shortly thereafter. And I do not remember an allegation of Randy Moss attempting to intimidate an accuser via text. So, is it still the same as Randy Moss? How is it the same as Randy Moss? Not only did Belichick sign Antonio Brown, he stood by Antonio Brown, and he played him days after he was sued for sexual assault. So yes, there are going to be some questions, and those questions should be answered. You signed a guy who threatened to punch a coworker, and then you stuck by him after he was accused of sexual assault. You brought that guy into your locker room, into your facility, and around your employees. So there are questions that need to be answered. And then the Patriots claimed in a statement that, quote, under no circumstance does this organization condone sexual violence or assault, end quote. But again, they stood by Brown and they played him. So if Bill Belichick was the leader that they seem to think he is, the leader that the fans seem to think he is, wouldn't he stand up there and own it and answer the questions? Part of your job is answering questions about personnel moves, especially when those moves were so obviously problematic. Yeah, that, or you could just turn and run, turn and leave when people start to ask you about it and then stare down a reporter. Hey, Bill, you're always telling everybody, do your job, do your job. Fine. Do your job, Bill. Do your job.
Yeah, we're focused on the Jets today.
Pete Thamel. Pete, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Jim, I'm great. How are you today?
Good, Pete. Good. Good to visit with you. Lots to cover. Why don't we start with the Wisconsin beatdown of Michigan on Saturday. Before we get to the Wolverines and their issues, Pete, what did you make of the statement that Paul Chryst and his team made?
Well, I really think it was an important moment for that Wisconsin program. Marquee game at home. They obviously had a down season last season where they lost a little bit of their identity. And I tell you what, in one afternoon, it seemed like it all came rushing back. You know, if you watch the first couple of weeks of the season, Jim, it wasn't all that surprising. Wisconsin didn't give up a point the first two games, and Jonathan Taylor may well be the best player in the country. And he ran straight through Michigan's defense, almost unimpeded for most of the afternoon. I think he ended up with 203 yards, 8.8 yards a carry. And look, Wisconsin isn't going to come trick you, you know? Like, you know exactly what they're going to do, and they're daring you to stop it. Michigan didn't have any answers. So, props to them, and props to quarterback Jack Cohn, who was 13 of 16 and just enough of a downfield threat to make the running game continue to be viable.
Pete Thamel is joining us. Well said. Now, Michigan struggles to beat Army, Pete, in double OT, but they did have a bye week to get ready for Wisconsin. Knowing everything that was at stake for Jim Harbaugh and Michigan, what kind of a performance were you expecting from them on Saturday?
Well, look, their backs are up against the wall. The thing about that Army game with Army taking them to overtime that was really concerning for Michigan was they just got manhandled on the lines. And, you know, it was interesting the celebration that Michigan and its players had after that game. Obviously, you're going to be happy you win in overtime and you avoid it. They celebrated like they won the Big Ten. And to me, I think the most disappointing part of this, if I'm a Michigan fan, was just that they had no answers from a strategic standpoint, but they also just had no juice. They had no life. They had no energy. They had no hustle. Harbaugh said that today. You know, they got completely out-hustled in that game. So along with the scheme issues, which are obvious, especially on offense, I just think there's general program issues. Like, is Jim Harbaugh reaching these guys anymore? Is that enthusiasm unknown to mankind being tuned out? Michigan just had no juice.
Pete Thamel joining us. No juice. And then all this talk, Pete, and rightfully so, about them having no identity. Like, if you look at Harbaugh's Stanford teams, they had an identity. They had a toughness about them, especially on offense. Why has he not been able to recreate that in Michigan?
Well, he's done a poor job hiring staff. Other than Don Brown, who's had a couple good seasons, although his tenure is certainly going to come into question with the way the defense performed against Michigan, and then obviously against Florida in the bowl game last year, and then he gave up 62 to Ohio State. But for the most part, Michigan's staff is not of the caliber of those high-end Big Ten teams. And what Harbaugh did, the pivotal move he made for this juncture of his tenure was he went out and wholesale changed what they were going to do on offense. And he hired an offensive coordinator from Alabama, Josh Gattis, who'd never called a play. And basically that pro-style DNA that you remember from Stanford, he completely tried to flip with a guy who's never called a play. And, you know, staff-wise, program philosophy-wise, if you're going to go from more pro-style to no-huddle, up-tempo, and hand the play calling to someone who hasn't called plays, that's a giant adjustment. And they have not made it well. Look, Michigan has skill, especially at the receivers position. They have, you know, they're not Alabama and Clemson, but past that, they have arguably as good a receiving core as anyone in the country. And they've been a little bit dinged up there, but Michigan hasn't figured out a way to get its playmakers the ball, and the identity is sort of stuck between stations, and it's just fuzzy.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. You mentioned Gattis and the way Harbaugh went about interviewing him and giving him that opportunity. But Pete, what about Harbaugh himself? Like, when you look at his reputation, it's that of a quarterback guru, right? Thanks in part to his work with Andrew Luck and Colin Kaepernick. But quarterback has been a consistent weakness in Michigan. Why is that?
Well, they haven't been able to lure an elite one. And, you know, there was a huge celebration when Shea Patterson transferred there. He was a five-star guy who had a couple nice moments at Ole Miss. But I really don't think Harbaugh did enough homework on Patterson before he got him. Shea Patterson got beaten out at Ole Miss, and they were not particularly sad to see him go when he transferred out of there. And he's a guy who a little bit reminds me of an AAU prodigy. He transferred, played at high schools in three different states and bounced around and chased the big rankings in the glory. And he had his dad kind of parading him out everywhere. And look, he's a guy that at this point as a senior in college really just hasn't produced and really hasn't lived up to some of that self-created hype. And in the meantime, Jim Harbaugh has not recruited in 5 years a single competent quarterback and developed one. The development of Patterson or lack thereof would be a huge concern. But if you're Jim Harbaugh and you have that great run with Kaepernick, and obviously Andrew Luck's going to resonate in every home in America, and you haven't been able to go out and sign and develop your own quarterback after 5 years, that's a distinct failure.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. So, Pete, what about the fan base? For instance, there have been some bad losses during Harbaugh's time in Michigan. Did Saturday feel different to you? Did that almost feel like a breaking point for a chunk of that fan base?
It really did. I ripped Harbaugh, as a lot of people did, after that game just for the systemic failures that Michigan had. And there weren't a whole lot of people, at least on social media, you know, defending Harbaugh. He's 40-15, Jim. He's won 74% of his games. So certainly you can't cast his tenure as a failure, especially compared to what Rich Rodriguez did there and what Brady Hoke did there. He has certainly brought Michigan back to respectability, but this is Michigan. You know, it's the winningest program in college football history, and there's a keen institutional ego there, and they believe they should be competing for Big Ten championships. And this right now, this version of Michigan is clearly not going to do that. And so it's sort of a classic collegiate conundrum where they are good, but is that good enough for that place? And I think it's important to note that Harbaugh only has 2 years left on his contract. I would venture to say of the Power Five schools whose coaches have a winning record, there are zero of them only have 2 years. Usually guys have 4 years left on their deal because people would use it against them on the recruiting trail. So, you know, firing Harbaugh, who obviously makes $7.5 million a year, and I think $5.5 million of that is guaranteed, you know, wouldn't actually be expensive compared to, like, if Auburn had to fire Gus Malzahn. You see some of these buyouts that are just, like, boggle your mind. They're like slot machine pinball numbers. So it's going to be interesting. I don't see institutionally Michigan having any imminent movement there, but it does feel like we're at a bit of a crossroads with Jim Harbaugh and Michigan here.
I think that's really interesting what you say, that he's got 2 years left on his deal and that you probably would not find anybody else in that situation. So bottom line, like when he got there, it seemed like he could stay forever and that he could probably retire there. Do you feel like he may have to start producing in order to get a new deal?
Well, look, I mean, Ward Manuel, the athletic director there, has been on the record, you know, as recently as May, saying, we want Jim to retire here, we want him to be the coach forever, all that kind of stuff. But at a certain point, you know, if there's a ceiling there, and some of this is athletic department management, too. Like, Jim Harbaugh hired Josh Gattis after a 20-minute phone conversation. That's not smart. You know, that's not doing your homework. That's not research. Nick Saban had this guy in his office. If he was a transformative football mind, with an unlimited ceiling, do you think Nick Saban, who had an offensive coordinator opening, would have let him go? So I do think at some point, like, Jim Harbaugh is one of these guys who's likely very difficult to manage from an athletic department standpoint. And, you know, it certainly has earned some autonomy. But, you know, it's institutionally, it's a fascinating decision. Because, look, if they hand him, you know, 4 more years right now, you know, at that same rate, I think that would be irresponsible. Just because – what has he done to earn, you know, he has not been one of the top coaches in all of college football, and he's earned that way. And they've got some tough games coming up. It's really going to be a fascinating stretch of football coming up for Michigan, especially if the program continues to not have any juice and look as listless as they did on Saturday.
Agreed. Pete Thamel, my guest. Pete, really quickly before you go, Tennessee is 1-3. They're coming off a 34-3 loss to Florida. As you point out, there's a good chance they could start the year 1-6. How large is that gap between Tennessee and the rest of the SEC powers, and how bad are things there?
You know, I think it's a canyon right now, and I don't think Tennessee's personnel is terrible, but Jeremy Pruitt does not have a team that's playing hard for him right now. They also don't have an identity. I think the key mistake that Pruitt made, and a lot of Saban disciples have done this, is he tried to copy and paste that model. And if you are foolish enough at Tennessee to believe that you can go out-recruit Georgia and out-recruit Alabama and play power football and beat them, I mean, that's just insane. And that's also negligence on the part of the athletic director, Phil Fulmer, for letting him hire Georgia's offensive coordinator and expect the same power football stuff to work at Tennessee that's working at Georgia with inferior talent. I think that place is a mess right now, and that's another place where there's no easy answers. The difference is Michigan's competent, you know, and they're going to win 7 games rolling out of bed. At Tennessee, that's a long road to a fix, and there's just no signs that Pruitt's the answer there.
And then, okay, if he's not, as a quick follow, as you wrote, quote, throughout his career, Tennessee AD Philip Fulmer has earned the reputation as a relentless backstabber, end quote. So where does Tennessee go from here, Pete? I mean, does that end up with Fulmer naming himself head coach?
I mean, that's the general expectation. Whether the powers that be in Tennessee let it happen or not is probably a different question. But Fulmer has always wanted to return. He's you know, really the last decent coach that Tennessee's had in the past decade. And look, he sees a guy like Mack Brown, who's the same age as him, going and having this career rebirth and getting, you know, the finances a decade later are drastically different than what, you know, Phil Fulmer made the end of his time at Tennessee than what coaches are making now. And so he looks and sees at Mack Brown, and, you know, ego-wise, certainly Phil Fulmer's always had a healthy ego, thinks he can do the same thing. So that becomes an institutional decision that's really, really compelling. And as we saw as their last coaching search unfolded, I don't have a lot of faith in the institution at Tennessee.
Jeff in SoCal. Yo, Jeff, what's up?
What up, my man? Hey, first of all, I went to Javier's last night. I got the Cabo Azul plate. That chili relleno, it caught my attention. I remember Andy Reid said he crushed about 12 of those in one night, so I figured if it was good enough for his fat ass, it would not disappoint. And, of course, he was right. But, Jim, the reason I'm calling, and just like what Drizzle did, I'm a Dolphins fan, and, dude, I need to tell the United States as a whole to lay off my damn Dolphins. I mean, breaking news, we suck. Jim, I can't even leave the house in Finn's gear because all people want to do is come up to me and talk about how bad they are. But, Romy, we signed up for this. I mean, you don't bring in Ryan Fitzpatrick to get you over the hump. You don't trade away 99% of your defense to go from a wild card team to a Super Bowl contender. They are trying to suck, and guess what? They are really damn good at it. But that's the strategy. I mean, meanwhile, you got Crab Legs Winston over in Tampa. You think they're going anywhere with him? Arizona Cardinals got their franchise QB, and they are 0-2-1. Congrats on your tie. Your rebuild is in full swing. You think the Jets are still happy about Crazy Eye Gates running that ship? No. The Dolphins, strategically speaking, are in a much better spot. Jim, we suck. We know we suck. We don't care. We have like 40 draft picks over the next two seasons. So leave the Dolphins alone. You're lucky they even suck ass for you bastards. War Beaks wearing a sports bra when he works out, and War Beaks catfishing Manti Te'o by sending him pics of
his... No. Oh, Jeff, you almost made it. You don't like that call. Although that is longer than you've ever gone without getting run. Let's go to Wichita. Drizzle. Drizzle, what's up?
Yo, what's happening with you, Romy Rome? How you living today, man?
Good, dude. Great. How about you?
Yo, man, I can't complain. You know what I'm sizzling? But, yo, man, I heard your boy Matt over there wanted all the smoke out in L.A. So I'm about to seal his lips up like a Ziploc right quick. Nice crack on Jerry Jones. Not bad for a guy who's got about as much business talking about football as Mia Khalifa. Bro steady using my name as a way to keep himself relevant. The same way Skip Bayless jock rides LeBron for clickbait. One of my calls got 1,000 views on YouTube, and your last two still ain't equaled that yet. Funny how you raid a nation after a win, but when your team gets dusted, you try to call out Dallas? Bro, 3-0, 1-2. You're better off arguing with Dolphins fans right now over who's going to finish last, because the rest of the league is using the Raiders and Dolphins as a second bye week. Now, bro, I'm through with you. What's my name? I'm out, Rome.
Go ahead and rack him. Rick in Buffalo. Rick, what's up?
If it sounds like I'm a little pumped up, Jim, it's because I am a little pumped up. Part of being a Bills fan is wearing your heart on your hoodie and letting your mind wander to faraway places. And this team's taking me back to the early 90s. I could have swore that was Pete Metzler's trucking dudes on that game-winning drive. And the way Josh Allen stole the game back after damn near giving it away had Jim Kelly written all over it. And with those a-holes from New England coming to town, this city's ready to friggin' explode. And how about A.B. clowning that fat pervert Bob Kraft yesterday? The Patriots could run the table, and they'd still look like complete morons for how things went down the last 2 weeks. The old hood man would sell off his firstborn if it meant winning a few more games. Well, maybe not his firstborn. That's the one he likes making out with. But his secondborn for sure. And don't even get me started on that fan base full of sheep. Patriot frontrunners would root for Ted Bundy if he could play lockdown corner. And save the my team's better than your team nonsense, because I've never given a damn. Win or lose, I'll always have the last word, and I'll always have the last laugh. And don't you ever friggin' forget it. And one last thing before I get out, Jim. I want to apologize for not being able to fit you into my schedule when I was in town last month. From the second I stepped off the plane, the SoCal fanboys were falling at my feet and kissing at my ass. They knew better than to get on my bad side. But I do have some good news for you, Jim. Cousin Corey invited me to the Rome family Thanksgiving. And I'm happy to report I'll be there with my plus one. You better tell Janet she might want to double the number she usually cooks for. Because my fat ass old man really likes to get down. War the Bills making Buffalo want to scream and shout. War the Bills giving us that Super Bowl feeling. And war that one-man wrecking crew, Frank Gore. Talk to you next week, Jim. Hell, I'm so wired I might call back tomorrow. Thanks for the vine. I'm out.
Rack him. You got it, Rick. Call back tomorrow. Call back Wednesday. Call every day. I may have a special Scrub Sunday edition of the show just for you, Rick, and the Bills. And I'll tell Janet what you said. And we'll have you and your fat ass old man over for Thanksgiving. I can't wait. My throat hurts. Pretending to be you, Rick. Wow. Let's go to Vancouver. Yo, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Romy. Just wait till Jake puts on some of those Midwest LBs, my man. And hey, man, with your consistent hammering of my guy Beaks in Studio City over the last few months for being such a fatso, you're officially on the Team Canada watch list, my man. And it's nice of Rick to take a break from grooming, teaching his doomed students. Why does this freak walk around a 5'6 acting like he's Suge Knight, Rome? Rick's just the jungle's version of a mall cop, a fat loser who garners no respect at all, but his pepper spray makes him feel like a tough guy. Can't you just picture Rick on a Segway, salt and fat stains on the handlebars, trying to flirt with preteens at Forever 21? And lastly, Rome, I don't know if this Drizzle guy is good or not, but I do know Drizzle is the stupidest name I've ever heard. Peace, man.
Rack him. Matt in Vancouver, man. That's how you do it. That's how you do it. Make sure you rack that call. Matt in L.A. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Jim Rome. Ah, fizzle, fizzle, fizzle. 4 days for you to respond, bro. I mean, real men handle it the same week or the same show, but it's all good, man. I guess you need it all weekend to craft that inferior-ass slap tag that you run. Yeah, I called out Plastic Face Jones because he needs to be called out unless you Dallas fans want to see Daniel Snyder snap Dak Prescott up, man. And yes, this is Raider Nation for life, bro. But I don't need to say your punk ass name for relevance, you puke. You got 25 followers, bro. I was trying to get you to 30. Do my good deed for the week. And I'm saying your name, Fizzle, because you ain't done squat yet, Fizzy Bobo. The jungle has seen many a shooting star become a crash landing, you chump. And that's what my name line that you stole from Snoop Dogg and Beanie Siegel might be playing to the rest of the cats, but all real G's know what's up, man. We could spot a Fugazi from a mile away, and you got that look, you Dallas diva. So keep coming at me, because I'm like Cassius Fizzy. I can go all 15 rounds repeatedly, you flash in the pan. That's all I got, Jim. War, it's Rick Eisenhower wearing his Congressional Medal of Honor every Wednesday. War, Billy Clarkson and Jeff in Richmond playing Dooley buffets. Outro.
Matt in L.A. I'm not really sure why, but that made me laugh a lot.
Good night now!